Good afternoon. This is KTOO, and I'm Clarice Larson. Thank you so much for tuning in. Capital City Fire and Rescue responded to a structure fire at the site of two historic abandoned cabins in the Mendenhall Valley this afternoon. Smoke could be seen from the surrounding area. No injuries were reported. Division Chief Brandon Bagwell says the fire was fully contained within an hour of the initial reports.
We had fire coming from the top, getting into the trees. We're not exactly sure what the cause of origin is just yet. It's going to be under investigation.
A fire department press release says citizens reported the fire. Callers reported a large column of smoke coming from the area across from Sherwood Lane and the Pavitt Health and Fitness. The extent of the damage to the surrounding area was unclear at the time of reporting. The cabins are nearly 120 years old, remnants of Juneau's short-lived dairy industry. The structures have been slowly collapsing for years, and this fire fully destroyed one of them. And Juneau residents will have their first chance to testify in front of the Juneau Visitor Industry Task Force tonight at City Hall or online at 5:30 p.m. The task force has been meeting since mid-December and is comprised of Juneau Assembly members and people involved in the tourism industry. The group is examining whether the city's current approach to managing tourism is working and recommend big-picture changes to the Juneau Assembly. That's as major cruise tourism developments are on the horizon in the capital city. So far, the task force has discussed topics like whale watching, downtown crowding, and flight seeing, among other issues. Last week, members heard from Goldboat President and CEO McHugh Pierre about the corporation's proposed plan to build a cruise ship port on the backside of Douglas Island. The task force is slated to dive into long-term planning and the draft policy recommendations for the city later this summer and fall. The task force is expected to finalize its recommendations on October 22nd. Residents will have another chance to testify before then on October 15th. This is KTOO. Thank you so much for tuning in. Good afternoon. This is KTOO, and I'm Clarice Larson. Thank you so much for tuning in. A critical deep ocean observation network that includes a long-standing station off the coast of Alaska has been saved from getting dismantled. As first reported by the New York Times, the Trump administration dropped its plans to get rid of the ocean and climate tracking system after the U.S. Senate unanimously blocked the move this week. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski and Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley sponsored the measure. It prohibits the National Science Foundation from spending federal money to remove equipment anchored off the coast of Alaska, Washington, Oregon, North Carolina, and in an area called the Irminger Sea near Iceland and Greenland. On the Senate floor Wednesday, Murkowski said the Ocean Observatory's initiative collects hard-to-access information that's critical for understanding warming seas.
And this is all happening at a time when everybody's talking about El Nino and what that is going to bring in terms of the potential for extreme weather events. This is not the time to be turning off one of our most valuable scientific assets.
In the Gulf of Alaska, Ocean Station Papa is located on the seafloor more than 2.5 miles beneath the water's surface. It supplies one of the longest-running data sets in the North Pacific, and it was initially slated to be removed next year. Now it'll stay there. Scientists have used the data for the station to understand the effects of marine heat waves, like the blob, monitoring ocean acidification and track conditions that affect fisheries. Debbie Kelly directs the underwater cable portion of the Ocean Observatory Initiative on the West Coast and says the stations are important for seeing what's going on throughout the water column, where satellites can't reach.
It's an incredibly biologically rich area. And so these measurements, because they're continuous in real time, we can see events as they're happening.
Kelly says hundreds of scientists use that information, and she hopes funding will soon be dispersed to reinstall equipment that's already been removed.
All of the uncabled moorings on the Oregon and Washington coast were pulled out of the water.
She says the removal began last year, and the final uncabled mooring on the West Coast was pulled out on Tuesday. The National Science Foundation said in a statement Thursday that it's developing plans to redeploy the equipment. And an attorney advising the state legislature says the Division of Elections likely lacked legal justification for disqualifying Dan J. Sullivan of Petersburg from running in the Alaska U.S. Senate race. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
The Division of Elections ruled Monday that Sullivan could not be on the ballot because, as the division director said, he did not file, quote, in good faith. That came after Senator Dan Sullivan and his Republican allies complained the Petersburg Sullivan, a retired teacher, intends to confuse voters by using the same name and party affiliation as the incumbent. Andrew Dunmire, an attorney with the nonpartisan Legislative Affairs Agency, wrote a nearly five-page memo on the controversy. Dunmire says that the Petersburg-Sullivan appears to meet the three qualifications the U.S. Constitution requires for senators. He's over 30, a U.S. citizen for 9 years or more, and would be an Alaska resident at the time of service. Dunmire says the Division of Elections has no authority to add a good faith requirement, which he says would, quote, improperly add to the exclusive list of constitutional qualifications. Democratic State Representative Andrew Gray of Anchorage requested the memo and is holding an oversight hearing on the subject Monday. Gray says he doesn't know the Petersburg man and isn't taking a position on his motives.
What matters is he qualified to be on the ballot, and what authority does the Division of Elections have to take someone off the ballot if they meet the requirements?
Gray says he suspects the Division of Elections is not acting as a neutral player here. He cited a 2024 case when the division argued in court that it had to let Eric Hafner, a federal inmate in New York, appear on the Alaska ballot as a Democrat. That was over the objections of the state Democratic Party because the elections division said the state had no authority to rule on his future residency.
In that case, he was allowed to stay on the ballot. And now we have a case 2 years later where there's a candidate who potentially would take votes away from the Republican incumbent. And in that case, he's removed from the ballot. So it appears that it's inconsistent, and it appears that the inconsistency might have a partisan motivation behind it.
Dunmire wrote that while a candidate's name can't appear in a misleading way on the ballot, that doesn't mean the Petersburg-Sullivan has to be dropped entirely. Instead, Dunmire says the ballot could be designed in a way that allows voters to differentiate between the two. Petersburg Dan Sullivan says his aim isn't to fool voters. He says he's dissatisfied with the namesake senator and wants to provide an alternative. He said by text that he's read the Dunmire memo and agrees with it. He has not yet announced whether he will challenge the state's decision to take him off the ballot, but he says he has sought legal advice. With help from Taylor Heckert in Petersburg, I'm Liz Ruskin in Anchorage.
And salmon is a staple traditional food in Alaska, but a growing number of Alaskans are discovering that they have a unique intolerance to the fish. It's an allergy not to the seafood itself, but to the parasites living in it. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra spoke with an Anchorage man who was diagnosed with the allergy last year and has a story.
I still have a fair amount of salmon here in the bottom.
Chuck Shaka is sorting through his chest freezer in his garage in Anchorage.
And then once I realized I was allergic to the worms in these fish, gave away a bunch more. Just kind of been sitting here for a while now, which is a little sad. I'm feeling sad just looking at them. But
about a year ago, Shaka had a violent reaction to eating the salmon that he and his family had caught dip netting.
I got pretty sick, which mostly just looked like I was puking for like 6 hours, and my wife and daughter were totally fine, and they had eaten the same fish.
When it kept happening, he went to a doctor. His allergist broke the news that he was allergic to a worm called Anisakis that's found in salmon and a broad range of other seafood. He had to stop eating all of it, but he was especially devastated to give up salmon.
Well, it felt like a gut punch. It feels like a pretty fundamental part of being who I am and also being an Alaskan is fishing and eating fish.
Shaka grew up fishing with his family in Bethel. Now, he and his wife and daughter aren't eating salmon. They gave most of what they caught last summer away. Shaka's story is an example of something head Alaska epidemiologist Joe McLaughlin says is a growing concern in the state.
Most seafood remains safe when it's properly prepared, and seafood allergic reactions remain relatively uncommon, although it does appear as though the incidence is increasing.
McLaughlin says epidemiologists don't know how many people in Alaska are allergic to the Anisakis worm, but he says the prevalence of the parasite is probably increasing, although scientists don't know exactly why. He says climate change is one likely factor, as ocean temperatures rise and the availability of nutrients shift. And he says the ideal hosts for the parasite are marine mammals like whales and seals. So as their populations rebound, so do the worms.
Anything that increases the population of marine mammals and fish that are part of the life cycle, you're going to get more Anisakis worms.
Much of the research on the Anisakis allergy takes place in Japan, which has a fish-forward culture like Alaska. Makoto Nojo, a researcher based in Tokyo, says the allergy is common in Japan. Some data show as many as 1 in 5 anaphylaxis reactions in the country are due to the worm.
Both.
He says it's both becoming more common and the diagnosis techniques are advancing as well.
Nojo says the allergy is often misdiagnosed, partly because there can be a delay in the allergic reaction. He says people with the allergy fall into two groups. Most people react to live baby worms, which is only a problem if you eat fresh, raw seafood. But a minority, like Chuck Shaka, have what Nojo calls classical Anisakis allergy. That's an allergy to the protein itself, which isn't destroyed through cooking or freezing. Here's Nojo.
Classical Anisakis allergy
immunotherapy is proving to be very effective.
Shaka pushed for treatment and eventually convinced his insurance to cover immunotherapy. In March, he started a once-monthly allergy shot, likely to reduce his allergic response. After 9 months to a year of treatment, he says his allergist will test whether he can try salmon again. Shaka really hopes the treatment works.
The first thing I will want to eat. I mean, if I can get my hands on some, I'll have some salmon from Bethel.
That won't be for many months, but he says this summer he's still planning to dip net on the Kenai River with his wife and daughter. He says fishing feels very meaningful, even if they end up giving away all of the salmon they catch. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And a quick look at weather today. It is 57 degrees and lightly showering in Juneau. Tomorrow is Juneteenth, sunny with a high near 71 degrees. This is KTOO.